This is the IBJ podcast for the week of July 19th, 2021, brought to you by First Person Advisors, a subsidiary of NFP. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Today's edition is actually a companion piece to the podcast from June the 7th, in which IBJ columnist Pete the Planner and I discuss how to pick a financial planner. My wife and I have been slowly working towards that goal, and we decided last week to have an official family preparatory meeting in which we would discuss our long-term goals and when we'd like to transition out of full-time work, which is a bit complicated because we're actually 10 years apart. We also tried to make a master list of all of the retirement accounts that we've collected over our professional lives and the small investments that we've made on our own. And we made some decisions, but we also made a big list of questions about elements of the retirement process that we realized we didn't really fully understand. So I have floated a message in the Midtown Parents Facebook group here in Indianapolis, asking folks to share some of their retirement questions. And I wanted to see whether or not some common themes would develop. Indeed, they did. Some common themes included whether it made sense to try to pay off our mortgages as soon as possible, what to do about other types of debt, the difference between Roth IRAs and regular IRAs, and how you can manage to put away any money for retirement when you have several kids at home and lots of debt to resolve. So I called Pete back to see if he could handle some of these questions for us, get us over the hump. Here's our conversation. As always, I'm happy to welcome to the IBJ podcast, Pete Dunn. How you doing?
I'm good, Mason. Good to be back for my 300th appearance on the podcast.
So you say that and you make me feel like you don't like doing this.
No, I love doing it. And I'm also very good with math. It is nearly 300. I like being on the show and I appreciate the return visit.
It's amazing. If you're good with math, maybe you can tell me how we've had 159 episodes and you've been here 300 times.
Dog years, my friend. Dog years.
Hey, I'm gonna jump right into the questions here because I got a bunch of questions for you today. First question is about real estate. So my wife and I converted our 30-year mortgage to a 15-year mortgage about 8 years ago. It is now conceivable that we could pay it off within the next year. That would save us like $10,000 a year. It would give me some additional peace of mind because I'm always looking for peace of mind. But I get the sense that paying off your mortgage is not a good idea just for the sake of paying off your mortgage and maybe saving some money.
I like when paying off your mortgage matches up with a life event, like sending your kid to college or retiring. Coming off a pandemic, while notable, isn't necessarily the sort of life event of justification of paying it off. If I may, you say you could conceivably pay it off in a year. Does that mean that takes extra effort to do so, extra payments to do so?
You know, it would probably require eating into our emergency fund.
Yeah. So that is a balance sheet move, right? That is just your net worth does not change by pulling money out of savings to get rid of a debt. So I would advise you, in my opinion, I guess I don't have to say my opinion. That's the whole point of this. I would not do that. Now, if it was your income that was naturally paying it off, then yes, that's a reasonable thing to do. But then the next part of that becomes, all right, what are you going to do with $10,000 a year? Like, if you do nothing, if you absorb it back into your lifestyle, if you get to just like buy new pants and things, then it's sort of a wasted opportunity. If that money then goes to a college savings fund or, you know, getting your retirement account where you need it to be, whatever, then it's more powerful.
Yeah, a lot of people had this question, actually. It wasn't just me. They just wonder, wow, wouldn't it be smart if I just paid off my mortgage? But it sounds like it's a case-by-case thing.
Well, so for me in particular, we have it set up that our mortgage will be paid off by the time our kids go to college. Now, as you would hope, or maybe don't care, we have been saving for college. But if we find that the expenses exceed our savings, then we're using that opportunity to cash flow whatever shortage we have because now we don't have that mortgage payment, which is substantial. So it is a very individualized basis in terms of looking at major decisions like that.
Okay. Well, as it happens, we will have the house paid off by the time the boy goes to college. So
nice.
We'll just leave it.
Another real estate question. Is buying real estate beyond your primary residence, like buying a vacation home or a rental property, is that a good retirement strategy? And if it is, where does it rank?
Well, it checks a few boxes, right? It is an asset that other people can help you own. It can create positive cash flow and passive income. I mean, these are all big buzzwords in the financial world. But I'll tell you, unless you're Mr. Roper or Mr. Furley, I don't know which one you would be from Three's Company, then, you know, it's not the ideal way to retire from an income perspective if you don't have the skills, wherewithal, or patience to be a landlord. And I think people underestimate what it is to be a landlord. They underestimate the financial risk. They underestimate the vacancy risk and then the non-payment risk. All of which, if you've got blood pressure issues, not a good way to go.
I think that was Mr. Furley's problem. I think it was the blood pressure that finally chased him out.
Yeah, you know, I was a reluctant landlord. Back in 2007, Mrs. Planner and I built a home. We had a townhome that we decided not to sell. We were like, let's just accumulate real estate. And so we did. We became noobs in the landlord biz, and it was heartache. I mean, it was just a pain in my neck. I like to think I've got a lot going on, and it was just one other thing. We had some reasonable tenants and others that to own their own circumstances were struggling, and then it became our problem. And I'm not a big fan of when other people's financial problems become my problem. I don't think they're terrible people or anything like that. It's just I don't have the patience for that.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm with you on that. Speaking of mortgages, of all the recurring debts that people like us could have, professionals, I guess, what are the best ones to pay off or try to pay off early? I'm going to take a stab here and say you want to get rid of your credit card debt first.
Yeah, generally because of the interest rates associated with that. Beyond that, I find depreciating assets such as cars, although I guess we could do a whole episode of how cars might not even be depreciating assets anymore based on the supply and demand issues in our automotive industry. But yeah, depreciating assets are right after that. Unsecured debts, you know, are sort of in that realm. I don't mind mortgage debt. It doesn't bother me. It's super low interest. You know, there's some certain tax advantages to it. It doesn't bother me.
About school loans?
Student loans? I find student loans are just one of those things that, and this is an anecdotal observation here, people just tend to become dismissive of that debt, and they get disorganized in thought. They say things like, well, we're always going to have it, so let's not make a special effort to get rid of it. I find that people somehow ignore it, and therefore it sticks around in their life for much longer than it needs to. It's not as simple as, oh, hey, you have a 10-year repayment period. Yeah, it doesn't work like that anymore. People have their debts drag on for decades. President Obama only paid off his student loans with a book advance just prior to becoming the president of the United States. And so both he and Mrs. Obama's debts. So it's not unusual for really intelligent, well-earning folks to have student loan debt hang on longer than they should.
So would you have advised the future president, you know, you should have gotten rid of that debt earlier?
I don't generally lob advice at government leaders. You know, I guess that's what Twitter's for. But okay. No, I mean, look, I think the interesting thing about that is, good, bad, or otherwise, it just simply, of all the other things, it's weird for me to, by the way, talk about the president's financial life, but it just wasn't a priority. And I guess that's my point. For a lot of people choose to move on to other things, home ownership, saving for their own kids' college education, get retirement stuff done, and they just keep punting on student loans. He got a quote unquote get out of jail free card with a book advance. Mason, I'm not saying that the average person will not get a book advance, but the average person will not get a giant book advance.
Okay, let's look at it through this lens here, because this is the next set of questions. This is about people who struggle to save any money for retirement. Here's the first scenario. We have a listener in the Midtown Parents Group who is in her early 30s. She has three kids. I don't know if there's a spouse in the picture or not. That's probably not germane. Either way, the idea of being able to save any money for retirement for the foreseeable future is just absurd to her, given all of the present and future financial demands of having kids, in addition to all of the student loans she still needs to pay off. Okay. She wants to start saving for retirement as soon as she can. How should she get started?
That's a very common thing we hear around here of, hey, my financial present and my financial past are using up a lot of my money. How in the world am I supposed to set money aside for the future? And it's a slightly complex answer because there's a lot of different on-ramps to it. Okay, so let's start here. It's not all or nothing. I mean, just by, you know, chipping off a percent of your income a year and trying to increase it over time is a good way to go, especially if you get a cost of living adjustment, then a raise, then you can just, you know, instead of getting a 3% raise, you get a 2% raise because you've put 1% into a retirement plan at work. So that's one oversimplified way to look at it. The other way to look at it is, I get that. That's a really challenging period of someone's life. And what it takes is not growing your lifestyle so aggressively that you never make room for retirement savings. So some people say, okay, I don't have anything for retirement. Let's just let it ride. Let's just keep increasing our lifestyle. And then by the time they get 52, 53, there's no going back. They can't reduce their lifestyle. They're out of time. Which actually strange is, depending on the person's income level, Social Security retirement might be a reasonable replacement ratio for them, meaning there's a certain level of the population that retirement's easier than people who make more than them because their wages are more easily replaced with Social Security income. Does that make sense, right? It's like, yeah. I'm pulling a number out of nowhere. Let's say you make $40,000, $50,000 a year. The replacement percentage of your Social Security retirement check is higher compared to someone making $140,000 a year. And so then the onus of retirement savings is more on the person making a higher wage as opposed to the person making a lower wage.
I'm going to ask a question where I think I know the answer because I think we've talked about this in the past. Should this family consider drawing the line on some of these expenses that they think that they need to pay, but maybe don't? For example, this listener, I think, expects to be paying for college for her kids, expects to be paying for weddings, for example, for her kids. Would she be well advised to, to let them figure it out for themselves?
I'm going to give you the technical answer, but I'm also, alongside of that, going to let you know that money and family are really tough to talk about because of emotions and obligations and upbringings and guilt and relationships and everything else. The technical answer is, from what you've described, the person has no business paying for their kids' college education or the beginning of a new relationship, a marriage. However, it's just not that simple. You know, depending on the circumstances, if it's a one-parent household, and this person wants to launch their child with the best opportunity, then maybe this person's willing to martyr their own financial life, go into student loan debt themselves to give their child a better opportunity. And it's not for me to say that that's a bad idea. I can tell you technically it's a horrible idea, but money's not that simple. I mean, the whole point of upward mobility is that one generation provides more opportunity for the next generation than they had. And so it would be coming from a place of privilege for me to say, don't do that, because I just certainly was not in that circumstance.
Here's a second scenario that is similar. Let's say I'm a gig worker, or my employer doesn't offer retirement accounts or benefits like a 401k. What is the best way for me to save for retirement?
You know, the government's been trying to figure out a way to make this easier, and they've had different names and products and whatever. But an IRA, a Roth IRA, IRA of course stands for not Irish Republican Army, but the individual retirement account. Most young people, and boy, that's a subjective term, will find themselves in a Roth IRA, which means they're putting after-tax money in it. It is growing tax deferred, and then they don't pay tax at withdrawal. That is the most advisable thing for most people. Others, depending on their income level, they may choose to have a deductible IRA, which is to, you know, put in pre-tax money into it. But that's what they have to do. And that's why, oddly, most people end up with IRAs at their bank, or because it is a place where they do financial transactions, and they need convenience, and they see a sign about IRAs, and the banker appropriately talks them into it. But yeah, that's ends up what happens most of the time.
And that's okay.
It's absolutely okay. It's funny, I was doing I did a show earlier today about when it's okay to break money rules. I mean, which is sort of funny because I've spent 20 years creating all these rules for people to follow, right? And I get when it's a big talking head or even a smaller talking head giving you all these rules, this is what you should do, this is what you shouldn't do. The harsh reality is just do the best you can and understand that the only thing that gets worse over time is that you get fewer and fewer options to solve the problems that you may be creating for yourself. And that's not to guilt someone into, well, if you don't open an IRA, you're making a mistake. I think that's what the financial industry has really struggled with, is getting people to understand that it's not a binary choice. It's not you succeed or you fail. It's that there's a mechanism for people to do the best they can given real life circumstances. And if we've not detected real life circumstances in the last 18 months as to why people can't do certain things, I don't know when we ever will, right?
My next question actually was about IRAs, because my wife and I were taking a walk and trying to take stock of our all the different like savings vehicles we have. And we realized that we didn't totally understand the difference between an IRA and a Roth IRA. Can you really dumb it down for me? Tell me, what is the difference again? Is one better than the other for a particular time of your life, or just one better than the other in general?
So a Roth IRA is when you make a deposit and you don't deduct your deposit on your tax return. So in other words, you're paying taxes on the income you use to put in there. And the reason you would do that, Mason, is because at the very end, you can take the money out tax-free. If you use a traditional IRA, or sometimes people just call it an IRA, but really it's a traditional IRA, you deduct the deposit from your tax burden that year, meaning you've never paid tax on that money. And then when you withdraw it, you're going to have to pay tax on everything. Okay, so it's a tax strategy. It's, do you think your tax rate at retirement will be higher or lower than it is now? And depending on what you think about that is whether you should get a Roth or traditional. Again, most people these days find themselves with a Roth, unless it's a tax strategy dependent on you trying to lower your tax rate now by going to a lower marginal tax rate. But again, most is a subjective term. Most people I see today, you know, 45 years old and younger, are absolutely going the Roth route.
Okay, let's take a quick break to digest this information and hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
First Person Advisors is now a subsidiary of NFP, the fifth largest insurance broker in the world. Your total reward strategies all in one place. The same local award-winning firm with global expertise and resources now in your backyard. Learn more at firstpersonadvisors.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. We're talking with Pete the Planner, who is answering questions from yours truly and our listeners about retirement.
Up until very recently, I had two 401ks. I had one from a current job, or my current job, and one from an account from a previous employer that I just let hang out there in the wind. You know, I never did anything with it. It was just there. I got the statements in the mail. It would go up and down with the stock market. It was my other 401k. In my mind, I think I thought I was somehow diversifying my investment strategy by having two different 401ks. Now that 401k has now been consolidated into my current one because that employer decided to stop their profit sharing plan. But we had several people who wanted to know, if you have more than 401k, what's the best strategy? Should you combine them, or are there situations where it's okay to have several?
I don't mind if a person has several, if they're an organized person, which, by the way, is sort of a fleeting thought, right? Like, how many really financially organized people do you know? And then the fees and the performance of the old 401k are okay. The default, in my opinion, should be to take a really hard look at your current employer's 401k and say, are the fees reasonable? Are the investment options reasonable? And if so, and in comparison to the old 401k, I would probably transfer the money into my current 401k. However, I will say, I had a friend who was an attorney, and his old law firm, which he no longer works, had sort of an exclusive retirement plan of things you couldn't get into anymore, which sounds sort of weird, but it was true. And so he kept that plan because it was a great investment that he could not get in his current plan. But I don't think most people are that savvy. Most people sort of view it in the sense of like, well, I guess two are better than one because I'm diversified, which is arguably true. But I just think it's about, I think it's about motivation too. Some people look at their old retirement plans and they stop caring about them because it feels like found money. But somehow if it's part of your current employer's retirement package, you care a lot more about it. And I would also mention, you might actually end up feeling better about your current employer, even though they didn't necessarily contribute to the balance that you had from your previous job. You somehow credit them with you having the balance you have in your current plan.
What are reasonable fees for a 401k plan?
Boy, this question has evolved so much in the last, or I guess the answer has evolved in the last 5 or 10 years. Back in the day, anything at 75 basis points, which is going to be 0.75% internal fees, was considered okay-ish, right? Anymore, because of index funds and because of scale, I mean, you can find an S&P 500 style index fund within a 401k at 5 basis points or 0.05%. And that 0.7% delta I just made reference to makes a really big difference. Like, it makes hundreds of thousands of dollars difference over the course of a career, depending on balances. That's not to say if your 401k is above 1%, that doesn't necessarily make it bad. It likely means you have a very small employer and they aren't purchasing in bulk, if you will. They're not getting bulk discounts. And so, you know, you're paying a buck and change or one basis point and change.
Does 1% mean
100 basis points?
1% of the assets that I have in that account.
Correct.
So if you get charged for a fee annually.
Yeah, if you had $100,000, you'd have $1,000 of fees a year.
Oh, here's a good one. A few people mentioned, and is my situation with my wife currently. Couples who have a significant age gap. Let's say you have a couple who are between 5 and 10 years apart in age, and thus have or could have different timelines for retirement. How do you start to advise these folks about how to do that?
I think this is one of the number one reasons why a person reluctant to have a financial advisor should have a financial advisor. If you have a significant age gap, I would 10 years is an interesting age gap, right? Because you're going to have a person reach Social Security retirement age prior to someone else. You're going to have them reach Medicare age prior to someone else. It absolutely comes into play. And for two reasons. Number one, oftentimes the younger person will find themselves gravitating towards retiring at the same time as the older person, which really shortchanges their earning years. And then the second one, well, it's more about the end. It's how do you make sure at the passing of the older person that the survivor still has the income they need to continue in retirement. And I see a lot of, or I used to see, I should say, I just don't get that much exposure anymore, but I used to see people who in an amateur way put together their retirement plan on their own. They completely ignore, miss that idea that what does the younger survivor do upon the death of the older person? And it's ugly. And I'll even go as far as to say, it's not uncommon for the survivor to just carry animus for the rest of their life of being left high and dry from a financial perspective, which that sounds like a really alarming thing for me to say, but it's just frankly true.
Well, I guess that makes sense. I mean, if the first person who goes probably incurred a lot of medical debt or potentially did, and it probably depleted more savings than they anticipated.
This is also a generational thing from a gender dynamic standpoint. You'll find maybe an older gentleman take care of everything. I got it. And then, maybe the person's wife does not have as much financial say or access to accounts. And so when that person's gone, it just gets so awful. I'll tell you, I've seen a lot of weird and unsettling things in my 20 years plus. And that's always at the top of the list. It's just heart-wrenching because it's hard enough to lose a loved one. Then you find that you don't even know how to access your own money, like from day one of the person gone. I'm seeing less and less of it, or I would guess there's less and less of it because as sort of, younger baby boomers become more digitally apt, right? But definitely the older baby boomers still struggle with that concept.
Okay, so seek professional help. And And this just occurs to me because I was thinking this when we were looking at picking on a financial planner. There's a guy who seemed to be really with it and had a great record, but he was, you know, like obviously in his 60s. And I think, well, you know, we're younger than this guy. We would rather have somebody who's closer to our age because we could continue to have that person with us over the course of our lives. And, you know, when this person won't, you know, be retiring in 10 years and then we'll have to start over.
That's a really interesting point, right? Because I think it's hard enough to find someone you trust and like, and you're willing to really turn your financial life over to in some respects. And then to just assume whoever they choose or whoever they sell their practice to is of the same, you know, ilk. What are the chances that you like that person? I don't know the percentages, but that's a valid concern. My financial advisor is, I think, 7 years older than me and will probably retire before me. And so I am trusting that his junior partners will do the job, or I'll be forced to make a decision then. But I know that's interesting, right? Because let's say I'm a 25-year-old guy, and clearly I'm not. Does that mean I want to choose a 25 to 30-year-old financial advisor? I don't know, because I look at it as an experience situation, and they also look at it if it's like, well, my life's going to change a lot from the time I'm 25 to I'm 55. Chances are I could probably have another financial advisor by my own doing, not because this person's retired.
529 plans. We've got a 529 plan through the Indiana College Choice Program to help save money for our son's college education. Do you want to quickly disclose your relationship to the program and then explain why it's a great idea?
I'm a paid endorser for the Indiana College Choice 529 Savings Plan. So there's my disclosure. And just so you know, in all sincerity, whatever I'm about to say next is not influenced by the fact that I'm paid to say great things about the College Choice 529 plan. I'll say this. I personally use it for my kids for a couple different reasons. The simplicity of having a dedicated plan for my children is a important to me. The tax credit that I receive for making contributions to that account is important to me. And I find the investment options and the fees to be reasonable. Now, I will say this, on my radio show here recently, we had a question about a person that found themselves with too much money in a 529, right? That's a big problem, right? So they weren't going to be able to use it on the kids' college education. They only had one child. And so they're like, okay, well, now we have to swallow fees and penalties and all these sorts of things, which is true. It's not severe, but it's true. So if a person finds themselves bumping up to what they think is too much money, they can always stop putting money into the 529 and then use a Roth IRA as the funding vehicle for a college education, because you can use Roth money for college education. So I don't know. It's very rare for someone to have too much money in a college account. And if it does happen, it's typically because it's a very thorough, organized family who also happens to have thorough and organized offspring who happen to get a scholarship. And then therefore the college fund turns into a Jeep, right?
Gotcha. Oh, well, good. So we've gotten a pretty good start with our 529. We probably have enough right now to pay for 1 year of college if the boy was in college today, but we don't know how expensive it's going to be in 13 years. So the question that occurs to me is whether we should be shooting for a particular number. Like in the same way, you know, that people generally say, you know, you need to shoot for at least $1 million by the time you retire. Is there a number that we should be shooting for to pay for our son's college education? You know, which I think, I mean, like, what is it now? Like, at a decent school, it's like $45,000 a year. In 13 years, God knows how much it's going to be.
I'm sure someone smarter than me can give you an exact number there to shoot for, and she would be able to tell you exactly what that is. For me, I think it's a bit of a moving target because you've got a few dynamics going on. Number one, you've got how even the pandemic has changed virtual education, even in higher ed, and how that could impact the costs. You've also got this slow-moving anti-college movement of where you don't necessarily need to incur student loan debt to have a good career, and that could theoretically bring down the cost of college. But I think the most significant thing that's going to happen is going to happen within about 4 to 5 years. And this, to me, will answer your question. So I'm not saying park your question for 4 or 5 years, but here's what's about to happen. There's something called an enrollment cliff, which is based on birth rates, that there's just going to be a lot fewer college students in the year 2025 and the years surrounding that. That is going to impact a college or university's ability to make ends meet. Giant facilities that require a ton of upkeep with a ton of faculty and staff. And so there will be a reckoning in higher ed within the next few years. And I don't want to be glib and say it's going to benefit guys like you and me, because that's a little rough, right? But I think conceivably, they either start charging more to make up for the fact that they've got fewer students, or the model gets redefined and it ends up trickling down to less tuition costs.
I like that. That makes sense. All right. Well, I've got enough information to take back to my wife now. So this might be,
yeah,
this might be it for a couple of weeks.
My pleasure. We'll talk soon.
All right. Have a good one.
My thanks again to Pete Dunn. Hey, just a reminder, his column on personal finance appears regularly in the print edition of IBJ, and you can find several years worth of his work at IBJ.com. And before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few stories in the latest print edition of IBJ I'd like to point out. First up, hundreds of homeowner associations in central Indiana have been taking steps to prevent an incursion of rental homes in their neighborhoods as national investment firms try to gobble up single-family properties and offer them for lease. IBJ's Mickey Shuey has more on the acquisition frenzy and how associations are able to create covenants to cap rentals in their neighborhoods. Also in this week's issue, Emily Ketterer has the latest on moves toward potentially combining the state's separate schools for blind and deaf students. The process slowed during the pandemic, but the state is now preparing to spend $13 million to kickstart the prep work. And Susan Orr explains how a local firm is bringing new technology and big data to the unassuming parking garage sector. And again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say it's quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics, and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbenner. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.